Welcome back. We begin our discussions in Parshas Noach. Parshas Noach, the parsha that describes the time when everything basically shut down for a year. I think we all know how that feels. And I'd like to begin by taking a look at a very puzzling Rashi. We begin, of course, before we get to the Rashi that I'd like to focus on, as we know, everyone knows, the opening pasuk of Noach contains room for two ways to look at Noach, because he's called Tzadik B'Dorosav, Tzadik in his generations. And that could go either way, as we know. Yesh Dorshim Lishvach, some people say that Oni tells us even more praise of Noach. In a generation like that, he was a tzaddik, a kal vachomer in a generation of tzaddikim. While others say that, in his generation, he was a tzaddik, perhaps not in other generations. And what is the common understanding? If he would be, for those that are derish lishvach, if he would be in a generation of tzaddikim, all the more so he would be a tzaddik. Well, why? So I think the simple understanding is that he would have had more support and to become even a greater tzaddik. But perhaps we'll see something else. So the Rashi that is very fascinating here is in Perek Zion, Pasuk Zion. And what's amazing about Rashi is that his job is to resolve the Pasuk, even though he often leaves us confounded with the resolution, but Rashi's job is done. So he's on the next pasuk, and we're left trying to work out what he said in the first pasuk. Perek Zion, pasuk Zion, Vayavo Noach. So the flood is happening. We cut to the chase, so to speak. Vayavo Noach, uvana veishto neshevana ito elateva. So him, his wife, his children, his sons, their wives, they all came to the teva. Mipnei me hamabul. Perek Zion. They came to the Teva, Mipnei Mehababel, on account of the waters of the Mabel, which sounds like something which is self-evident. I mean, that's what the Teva is all about. It's about the Mabel. Why does the Pasuk feel the need to say they came to the Teva? Because of the waters of the Mabel. And Rashi says something which has sent people reeling ever since. It says, Rashi, Af Noach Miketane Amana Haya. Noach had, to some degree, diminished faith, lessened faith. Ma'amin ve'eino ma'amin, she'yavo ha'mabel. He kind of believed, but also didn't fully believe, yes or no, that the mabel would actually occur. Ve'lo nichnas le'teva ad she'dachkuhu ha'mai. And that's why the pasuk says, you know why he entered the Teva in the end? Because the water forced him to. In other words, that's what clinched it. But barring the water, Noah himself was wavering, it seems, a little bit. And of course, the words of Rashi need to be contemplated and understood. After all, this does not seem to be a matter of faith. Faith, in our experience, means no one's told you. If Hashem appears to you, it's a slightly different dynamic. For us, faith is what we have to go on. But HaKadosh Baruch Hu, b'chvodo v'atzmo, has appeared to Noah, and communicated with him directly, and told him plainly that he is going to bring a mabel. That doesn't sound to be an issue of faith anymore. If anything, it could be an issue of denial or disobedience or that type of thing. How can one have lessened faith when Hashem himself has communicated what is to happen? What's more, Noach, as we know, has spent the last 120 years building the Teva. That's a lot of time spent doing something if you don't really think it's going to happen. And it doesn't sound like he left anything out. So he seems to be very dedicated to the Mabel idea over the last decades and over a century. And still Rashi says, he was never really sure. He looks sure. The Bartanura, who is famous, of course, for his Perush on the Mishnayos. He's the primary commentator on the Mishnayos, but he does have a short commentary on the Torah, Rashi specifically. And the Bartanura says very elegantly that the reason why Noah didn't fully believe that the Mabul would happen is because he had much greater belief in Hashem's mercy. As if to say, the Mabul is a punishment. Punishment could be averted through the attribute of mercy. We see HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave them so much time. I mean, 120 years is a long time. Even not in politics. And they'll be given more time. And then when the time comes, it's another 7 days. Rashi tells us, because that was the Shiva of Mr. Shelah. It's not appropriate. It almost sounds like we're looking for any excuse almost to delay, which makes perfect sense, because if Hashem is merciful and activates the attribute of mercy, then there will be indefinite stays of mercy. And therefore, says Bartanura, when Rashi says that Noah didn't fully believe that the Mabul would happen, it doesn't mean he doesn't think Hashem is capable of bringing a flood, but it means that he placed more stock in the ongoing notion of Hashem's mercy. And indeed, it really is a terrifying shock when you reach the stage, which we have never to reach, where it's just too late, and the time for mercy is over. So this is the explanation of the Bartanura as to why Noah never, until the final moment when the waters forced him in, he didn't really believe that the Mabul would happen. But there is another approach to Noah's reluctance to enter the Teva. And it comes from the Chasam Sofer. And it's a big chiddush. The Chasam Sofer, as we know, is capable of propounding chiddushim. And he raises a simple question. Why a Teva? Why is the way that Noah and the animals to be saved specifically come through building an ark? And the background to the question is, with so many other ways, one could say lower maintenance ways, easier ways, for Noah to be saved. According to the Medrash, the waters of the Mabul did not fall in Eretz Yisrael. Eretz Yisrael was spared from the Mabul. It's based on the Pasuk in Yechezkel. The Pasuk says about in Yechezkel about Eretz Yisrael, Lo gushma b'yom zam. It was not rained upon on the day of wrath. That's a reference to the Mabul. So Eretz Yisrael is Mabul free. So let them go to Renana for a year and be safe. But it takes the form of a teva. And lest we say, well, the teva was necessary because it works through natural means, the teva was a miracle anyway, as Ramban points out. The cubits, or the dimensions of the teva, are not that big. 300 by 50, however you factor what an amma is, it's not that big when you consider all of the animals to be there. There's no way naturally they could fit in there. Even if the ammas were chazanish. Because if they were, then all the animals were also shir chazanish. So that doesn't help. And finally, and again, basic questions, which we might sometimes forget to ask. Why does Noah need to be in the Teva for a year? Why does the whole process take a year? We normally see it as the punishment for that generation. Their punishment was probably over by the end of the day. We're talking about boiling hot rain, pelting down a day, if not a week, and then it's over. But it takes 40 days. And 40 days is just the beginning, the whole drying out process, and it's a year before Noah is out. So why take a year over something that seems to have could have been taken care of in a much shorter time? And here, the Chasam Sofer has a very delicate idea. Because when we come to talk about Noah, there is something that seems to be missing. Namely, that he didn't somehow affect any salvation for anyone outside of his family. which could take one of two forms. Either he didn't daven for them, or he didn't daven for them with a full heart, or he didn't remonstrate with them. He didn't, after all. Rashi tells us that the idea behind 120 years of building the ark is that people should see him, and people should ask him, what are you doing? And he should tell them, the end is nigh. And perhaps that should bring a turnabout within them. And over the course of 120 years, not one person had a change of heart. There's certain people that would be calling in their funding by that stage. So what's it all about? Well, and we see, in fact, based on the Haftarah, the Haftarah refers to the flood as May Noach, Noach's flood. We like to talk about Tevas Noach, Noach's Ark, that's his. But the pasuk calls it May Noach, and the Zohar explains, because it's attributed in part to Noach, of all the things to say. And there's many ways to explain why it is that Noach was not successful. The Chasam Sofer himself, as do others, understand that Noach had a very mild disposition. He's called Noach for a reason. Noach means easygoing. He's an easygoing person. He's not confrontational. He is more shy and retiring. And therefore, to take on the group of brutes that were the world population in his time, it wasn't something that was in his disposition to do. And it can be explained. And the goal is not to indict Noah. But at the end of the day, no one else came. And here, says the Chasam Sofer, and it's based even in earlier sources, that means that even when Noah is saved, everyone is destroyed and Noah is saved, but he doesn't have an easy time of it. He cannot live in luxury while the world is being destroyed. Because to a certain degree, there is a question mark on Noah. Why is no one else here in the Teva with you? And I think we're done a disservice by many of the, certainly the picture books that the children bring home. When you see Tevas Noah in those books, so everyone's smiling. The sun is shining, and all the animals are happy, and Noah is happy. It's like they're on their way to a cruise. For a year. And the reality was that it was horrendous. And in fact, aside from it's Noah and the animals, it is a round-the-clock job. There is a fascinating account. It's mentioned in a number of places. The Gemara itself in Masechet Sanhedrin talks about this. That Avram, at a certain point, actually questioned Shem ben Noach, who was in the Teva, Noach, his wife, Shem, Ham, and Yofes, and their wives. And Avram had occasion to meet Shem. Where? In Parshas Lech Lecha. Because with the episode with the war of the four kings and the five kings, so the four take over, and then Avram goes to war with them and defeats them miraculously. And who comes out to meet him? Malkitzedek Melech Shalem. He brings out refreshments for Avram and for his soldiers, whoever is there. And Malkitzedek, Rashi tells us, based on Chazal, is none other than Shem. And this is a point that Avram finally had the opportunity to speak to Shem and to interview him, so to speak, about that. What was it like in the flood? And Shem told him. I mean, parenthetically, I think it's very interesting that Avram never, for what it's worth, he never made his way to Shem just prior to that, just to speak to him. Shem must have been one of the outstanding personalities, both spiritually and historically. I mean, he has first-hand experience and knowledge of what happened in the Teva. But Avram was busy with other things. Were it not for the war, they never would have met. But now that they've met, they start talking. And Avram says to Malkitzedek, what was it like? And Malkitzedek said, it was an absolute nightmare. We didn't get a moment's rest. They were in charge, just those four. And also parenthetically, seemingly, all four of them were involved, meaning including Ham. Although Ham never really goes down as having done anything right, because he's the father of Canaan and Mitzrayim, etc. And he's really the bad son within the ark, but I don't think they let him shirk his duties during that year, which means that he didn't get time off just because he's a bad son. Everyone was involved, including Ham. Zachur Latov, at least in that respect. Either way, says Shem ben Noach to Avram, all the animals ate at different times. And you can't be late. And we know what happened to Noah when he was late. He got mauled by a lion. That's the thanks he gets. And all of this was, in a sense, as much for Noah's sake as it was for everyone else's sake. In other words, this is the rectification of Noah, having not shown enough concern for the people of his generation. He now needs to show unlimited concern for everyone who's under his care in the Teva. And in this respect, says Chasam Sofer, the Teva was a salvation for Noach, but also a punishment for Noach. So much so, the Alshe HaKadosh says that the wood, and we know that it was cedar wood, but it's not called cedar wood. It's not called not Erez. It's not called Atzei Shittim, which is what cedar wood is. It's called Atzei Gofer, and it's covered with kofer, right? V'chofarto, it's covered. V'chofarto doesn't mean to cover. V'chofarto is from the expression kapara. The teva is an atonement for Noach. It's a kofer. So much so, says Chasam Sofer, that if you want to know why the whole enterprise, the whole process lasted a year, whereas the punishment for those who were to be wiped out couldn't have taken more than a few days, that's the answer. Those first few days were for those that needed to be wiped out. But for Noah, it was just beginning. The rest, the other 51 weeks of that year were for Noah. Everyone else is done, is finished with. But Noah needs to get his kapara and to show this unlimited concern for everyone under his care for the balance of a full year. And this, says Chasam Sofer, is what the Medrash means when it says, if he was in a generation of tzaddikim, he would have been a greater tzaddik. It doesn't mean only, as we initially thought, that he would have more support, a better atmosphere to develop even more. It means this one thing that was holding him back, he was not able to confront Rishayim. That wasn't in his disposition, and that therefore led to other things. Well, that wouldn't be a problem if he wasn't in the generation of Rishayim. If everyone around him was a tzaddik, to be mild when you're surrounded by tzaddikim is perfect. When you're surrounded by Rishayim, it's a problem. So the one mark against Noah would not have existed would not have been a liability for him had he existed in a generation of tzaddikim. And with this in mind, says Chasam Sofer, perhaps we can gain a new insight as to why Noach is reluctant to enter the Teva. He doesn't go in until he's forced to go in, because the Teva is a punishment for him. And therefore, unlike the Bartanura, we hear the Chiluk, unlike the Bartanura who says that Noach delayed going in because he thought until the final moment, maybe Hashem will have Rachmanis on them and not bring the Mabul. For Chasam Sofer, until the final moment, he thought maybe Hashem would have Rachmanis on him and not make him go through with actually spending the entire year sealed in with all of these animals that he then needs to take care of in this incredible way. And this gives us, I think, new insight into, first certainly into that Rashi, Noach is not eager to enter the Teva. He's hoping for Rachmanis for himself as much as for everyone else. But what is true is, and this I think is a point that can go unnoticed, is that Noach is not static. People have their appraisals of Noach. People have their theses about Noach. But to understand that all of the discussions, and it's a simple point, but I think it really makes a difference. Noach is a progression. All of the discussions, is he a complete tzaddik? Is it for his generation? For other generations? All of these discussions, says Reb Zalman Sirotzkin in those nine Torah, they are specifically Noach as we meet him in the beginning of the Parsha. Because in the beginning of the Parsha, he's a private citizen. He's minding his own business. And according to Chazal, maybe he shouldn't have been minding his own business. And therefore, there's a certain indictment. However, by the time the Mabul's over, Noach is a different person. we don't have the same discussion with him anymore. You're talking about Noah, who spent 120 years in fulfillment to the degree that he could of building the Teva. And he spent an entire year involved in kindness, taking care of everyone. The Noah that emerges is not the Noah that entered. And thus we find that the Korbanos, and this the Pasuk says, when Noah offered Korbanos, which he did, after the year of the flood, the Pasuk says, Vayarach Hashem es reach hanichoach. Hashem, there was a pleasing aroma, and based on that, Hashem says, I will never bring a mabul again. That is top level tzaddik, because this is Noah after the flood. Everything changed from before the flood to afterwards, including Noach. That's the point of the Osnaim Torah. It's an oversimplification to make your comments and then never look back, even as the Parsha progresses. As the Parsha progresses, Noach progresses. But there is... I'd like to come back to this meeting between Avram and Melchizedek. And as we said, they just happen to have met, so to speak. Because from the way the Gemara describes it, it sounds like, what did Avram glean from Melchizedek on that occasion? Information, to know what it was like. You didn't know what it was like, now you know. Shem told you. But in one place, the Medrash actually tells us more. This meeting is also discussed and recorded in the Medrash Tehillim, Medrash Shocher Tov on Tehillim, in Perek Lamed Zayin. And first it goes through, Avram asked Melchizedek, how were you able to leave, and what schus were you able to leave the ark? He said, we didn't rest, we didn't get a full night's sleep for the entire year. And then says the Medrash, Omar Avram, Ma'enu. Avram begins to think. He ponders, he contemplates, and sees what he can learn from this, and says, consider. Look at these people. Were it not for the fact that they performed such kindness for these animals, they would never have left the ark. So what does that tell me? Says Avram. Ani, im esem bnei Adam. What if I do kindness with people? They're in the likeness of Malachim, right? Which Rashi also says, Tzelem Elokim. Malachim are also Betzelem Elokim. It's interesting that the Medrash describes man as being Betzelem Shel Malachim, but they're all Betzelem Elokim. Al achas kama v'kama, how much more so will I be saved from any bad things? Miyad vayita eshel. Avram has his famous eshel, which is Rosh HaTevis. Achia, Shtia, Levaya, right? Eating, drinking, then company going your way. Or some say, Achila, Shtia, Lina, right? To eat and drink and then to lodge there. That's the famous Eshel of Avram Avinu. Interestingly, it's referred to in the Torah in the end of Parshas Vayera, but the Medrash says that the idea came from his meeting with Melchizedek in Parshas Lech Lecha. And what is so fascinating about this? Avram and Noah are constantly being compared with each other. Even Rashi says, and you see even in the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos, the 10 generations from Adam to Noah, then 10 generations from Noah to Avram, and you see that Noah walked with Hashem, but Avram walked before Hashem, and so on and so forth. And Avram always comes out looking much better. And ultimately, he was on a higher level. We never imagine that at least part of Avram's kindness, his chesed enterprises, were actually inspired by Noach. We see Avram as being fully self-made. His ideas about how to be kind and how to take care of people, where does Avram get them from? From Avram. If only Noach had those ideas. But he didn't. And here we see it's not so. In other words, Avram, of course, is already very communally involved until that point. But he takes things up a notch on the basis of hearing from Shem ben Noach what the Teva was like. Which means that Noach actually has a schus in all the kindness of Avram. If it was his kindness that inspired Avram to raise his levels of kindness, then one who inspires someone else has a share in all their kindness. So I think it's very interesting that Noah doesn't get left behind totally in this regard. He actually is a force of inspiration behind Avram's spectacular levels of kindness. It's very interesting. I think if ever there was an example of mitzvah gereres mitzvah, it's this. Not only mitzvah gereres mitzvah across the generations, where Noah's mitzvah then led ultimately to Avram's higher level of mitzvah, but as we mentioned, seemingly, this meeting never would have happened if they hadn't met in the war. And why did they meet in the war? Why does Avram go to war? He goes to war to save his nephew Lot. That itself was an amazing gesture on Avram's part, to put himself out for Lot in that way. He could very easily have said, well, you know, these are the people that Lot got involved in. It's either not my problem, or it's too dangerous, or whatever it is. And Avram, as soon as he hears his nephew's in trouble, he gets everyone going, and he goes. It's an outstanding mitzvah. And mitzvah, gereres mitzvah. Were it not for the first mitzvah, to go and save Lot, he never would have then been inspired to do all those other mitzvahs based on his meeting with Melchizedek. So the interplay, which is often undiscussed, I think, between Noach and Avram, really is has a fascinating source in this Medrash Tehillim, Medrash Shocher Tov, in Perek Lamed Zayin. And in fact, there is a further point. There is quite a well-known Medrash. It's mentioned in a couple of places, in Yalkut Shimoni and elsewhere. One of the pieces of Noach's Ark actually makes an appearance later on in Tanakh, namely Megillas Esther, where the Medrash tells us that Haman receives advice from his wife, Yasu Eitz Gavoa Chamishim Ama. Let them get a gallows 50 amas tall and hang Mordechai from there. Where are you going to get a gallows 50 amas tall? I'm not sure if Zeresh really had considered it that far, the practicalities, but off goes Haman in search of a beam, a piece of wood 50 amas tall, and he finds it. One of the beams from Tevas Noach, which was 50 amas wide. How does he find it? I don't know. Where did he find it? I don't know. But he found it. And the Medrash says, Hayah Sameach Simcha Gadola, he was delighted that with his find. And this is how he's going to hang Mordechai. One might say he was beaming with pleasure. But what is the meaning behind this? There must have been other pieces of wood, 50, presumably. I mean, Noah found a lot. So the Znaim LaTorah says that the thinking, the reason why Haman was so happy that he found this piece of wood, is that the piece of wood brings us back to the Madrega of Noach. What Haman is reticent about, what he is somewhat anxious about, is going up against the Jewish people, as we know. And yet, what he sees in this piece of wood from Noah's Ark is what you could call the great equalizer. In other words, everyone's descended from Noah. Even Haman's descended from Noah. And the extent to which you can trace back the origins of kindness to the universal father, who's Noah, so that could be seen as taking the bite out of the Jewish people, as if to say, what makes them so special? What are they? Are they kind people? Are they moral people? We're all from Noah. That's why the beam from Tevas Noah was such a find for Haman, because maybe the Jewish people don't really have that much over him anymore. Are we not all the same? Have we not all one father called Noah? So why did it backfire for Haman, as did everything else? For the simple reason that of all the descendants, as we see from this Medrash in Tehillim, of all the descendants of Noach, and Noach, you can't take it away from him. He has this year of incredible kindness, this unbelievable Madrega. But who was inspired to emulate it? I mean, we're not hoping for another flood, so it's not going to happen that way. But who was inspired to emulate and to implement that kind of kindness and that approach into their day-to-day living? Only Avram. And therefore, from a certain point of view, even the beam from Noah's ark ended up being a strike against Haman. Because here's Haman saying, look, we're all the same, we're all from Noah. But the answer is, but are you all the same? Who took the lesson from Noah? Only the father of these people. And that was further, was a move against Haman. So it's very interesting just to see how all of these these comments are coalesce and give us a deeper picture into the themes and the forces at play here. So from one Rashi to another, and I mention this Rashi specifically because not only, again, is it a well-known comment of Chazal that Rashi quotes, but also it will give us, as is always valuable, more of an insight into Rashi's methodology. Rashi, as we know, is a whole world. And here we refer to Perek Ches, Pasuk Yud Aleph. Noah is already sending out the birds to find out, has the ground dried? Which itself is very interesting, because even when he discovers that it has dried, it doesn't help him, because he's not allowed to leave the Teva until Hashem tells him he's allowed to leave. But for what it's worth, he wants to know. And so as we know, first he sends out the raven, and that's a lost venture. Raven is not really too helpful. And then what about the dove, the yonah? Even then, the first time, nothing. But the second time, already something. Perek Ches, Pasuk, Yud, Aleph. Vatavo, and he waits in increments of 7 days. And as the Rabbanel explains, because every week is there's room to expect more, not only just in terms of time elapsed, but the position of the moon, as we know, can affect the tide. And therefore, there's room to anticipate maybe a significant ebb another week in. Either way. So, Ve'yachalot Shivas Yomim Acherim. Sorry, Pasuk Yud Aleph. Vatavo Elav Hayona Le'es Erev. So the dove comes back in the evening. V'yinei Alei Zayis Taraf Befiha. And behold, there is an olive leaf, which is as torn off in its mouth or in its beak. And that's now Noah knows. If he can get to it, to the branch of a tree, the waters are abating. Vayeda Noah kikalu hamayim me'al ha'aretz. Noah sees that the waters are already receding. That's the simple translation, shall we say. If we look at the word taraf, Bine alezayis taraf befiha. So taraf is in the word taraf, which is to tear. Taraf is ripped, ruptured. So taraf is tear. I mean, it tore off. So once again, the picture that people have of like an olive branch being brought back, it wasn't a branch, and it wasn't even an entire leaf. It was part of a leaf. And it had to be part of a leaf, because otherwise there's no way to know that he got it from a tree. If it's a whole leaf, maybe just found it on the water. So that doesn't help anyone. So it needs to have been actually extracted from a tree, and you can see that if it's torn. Okay. And Noach knows. But Rashi cites Medrash Agoda on the words taraf. First he gives the pshat, taraf, chataf, torn. The leaf was torn. Medrash Agoda. But you know there is a medrash here, says Rashi, that taraf is lashon mazon. It means food. Like teref, hatrifeni. Terefi, teref beves. Okay. And moreover, befiha is darshaned as a speech. Amra, says the dove, yihiyu mizonosai merurin kizayas. Kazayas, let my food be bitter as an olive. Biyodo shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu, getting it directly from Hashem's hand. V'lo metukim kidvash bidei basar v'dam, and not sweet as honey from a human being. In other words, the dove comes back with a message. The message is not just that the waters have abated. The medium is also a message. The olive leaf itself. And it's coming to say, this olive leaf, it's something bitter, but I got it straight from Hashem, and that's preferable to getting even sweet things from a human being. So that's obviously a very intriguing and fascinating statement from the Gemara. The question, of course, is why does Rashi talk about this? After all, Rashi's job is to explain Pshuto Shel Mikra, as he said in last week's Parsha, Perek Gimel, Pasuk Ches, Ani Lo Basi Ela Lo Pshuto Shel Mikra, I've come to resolve the Pshat. So the Pshat, Rashi says, of Taraf is Chataf. Taraf means torn. That's it. It was ripped. It was a torn piece of leaf. And that's the end of that. For Rashi then to get involved in, but you know, the Taraf, according to the Medrash Haggadah, it could also mean food. And if that's true, then it's a message. And this seems to be way in the realm of Medrash and way far away from the sphere of Rashi's commentary. So the reason why the Gemara says it, and the reason why the Gemara says it, as Ramban points out, and again, these are simple points. What difference does it make to us what type of leaf it was? As if to say, and had it been a leaf from a different tree, that's also not evidence. All the trees were covered, whatever leaf it is. But the Pasuk makes a point of telling us that it's an Alei Zayis. Had the Pasuk said, V'hine Alei Tarapafia, there was a leaf torn. Oh, leaves mean trees. Trees means waters have abated. That's that. But the Pasuk makes a point of saying, no, but it was an olive leaf. Why? Why does the Pasuk tell me more than I need to know? Because apparently it wants to tell me more. Namely, this additional message. There's a reason why it was an olive leaf. That's, according to Ramban, that's really the base in the pasuk within the statement, the fact that the Torah goes out of its way to specify what type of leaf it was, that it was an Alei Zayis. But for Meforshei Rashi, it seems that there is something else here. If we look again at the pasuk, again we're in Perek Yud Ches pasuk. Perek Ches pasuk Yud Aleph. Vatavo Elav Hayona Le'is Erev. So the dove returns in the evening, v'hinei alei zayis tara pafia, and there was an olive leaf ripped in its mouth. Okay, that's the pshat as we've seen it. But there is a basic shaila here, and Rashi actually deals with this question. The pasuk has moved from loshen zohar to loshen nekeva, from the masculine form to the feminine form. In other words, vatavo elav, Yonah, vatavo, not vayavo, vatavo. Sounds like the Yonah is dealt with in the feminine form. As indeed the Pasuk says, befiha, not befiv, befiha. But in the middle, it says, vihine alei zayis, taraf, befiha. But if it's befiha, then it should have been tarfa, as befits the feminine form. So how do we explain that the Yonah is a feminine form, but the Pasuk uses the word Taraf? And Rashi actually addresses this earlier in the Pasuk. And Rashi says, very interestingly, that it was a male dove. And therefore, it could answer to either. As if to say, the word Yonah itself is a feminine word. It looks like a feminine word, Yonah. It is a feminine word. However, within the species of Yonahs, there's males and females. Which means if it's a male dove, so it could answer both to the feminine as per the word Yonah or the masculine because it's a male. And therefore, says Rashi, seemingly, that's what's happening here. And that's why it says Taraf in the masculine. However, it could be that Rashi is not entirely, on a pshat level, that's the answer. But as we know, Rashi will take recourse to Drash if he's not entirely happy with what's going on in the pshat. Because even if it's true, and it could be true, that it was a male dove, but even so, why go back and forth? I mean, literally within the same phrase, Taraf Bafia, that's such an abrupt shift from masculine to feminine. That's very unusual to have within one phrase. There are certain words, Rashi tells us in the beginning of Parshas Vayishlach, there are certain words that can be referred to in the masculine or the feminine, but normally consistently, at least in that context. Shemesh, Rashi gives examples of, you know, both. Ruach, machaneh, that's why it starts. Machaneh, there. Okay? So there is such a phenomenon that words could answer to both. But it should at least be consistent within one sentence, as a rule. And here, toch kedei, literally, toch kedei dibur, right? With it, we go from taraf to befiha. And maybe that's what is moving Rashi to say that the word taraf, it could be, there's a different resolution. Maybe the yona is just feminine. And maybe taraf, the reason why it says taraf and not tarfa, is because taraf isn't a verb. It doesn't mean that it tore off. But taraf is miloshen mezonos. It's about, its food was in his mouth. Taraf is a noun, not a verb. And that's a further answer to Rashi's pshat issue. That's why Rashi brings it here. Additionally, by the way, without getting too much into the details, the word taraf is unusual because normally the past tense of a verb like that will be patach and kamatz, like shomar or omar or gomar. So it should have been taraf if it's a. So taraf itself also seems, just the vowelization seems to indicate that maybe it's a thing, maybe it's an entity. And Rashi says, yes, according to the Gemara, it is. It's about mezonos. But the question that remains for us, I think, having discussed a little bit, and we always need to keep an eye on Rashi's his methodology, why does he bring things in, and at what point, and in what way? But what about this message from the dove? That itself needs to be contemplated. And there's two ways to ask the question, or maybe there's two parts to the question. Firstly, since when is it the dove's job to start giving life lessons or Musar lessons to Noach? His job is to find out whether the water is abated. And he comes back with a Musar shmooze. Better this from Hashem than that's very good. He can hold forth back in the ark with the other animals. But it's very interesting that where's the room here for such a lesson? And aside from which, he seems to be preaching, or she seems to be preaching, Torah ideals. But it actually sounds like the opposite. It actually sounds like the height of ingratitude. Because the basar vadam that this dove is saying, I do anything I can to avoid it, is actually Noach, who's been doing everything within his power, working tirelessly to feed the dove as well as everything else. I mean, that doesn't sound like hakara satov. That doesn't sound like a due appreciation. Here's a dove. Noach's been feeding it for a year, and the dove says, you know what? I prefer an olive leaf directly from Hashem than anything from you. That's nice. What if you said that this time last year? You'd be over. So it's not exactly biting the hand that feeds it, but it's indicting the hand that feeds it. So that doesn't sound like a much midos at all. And it's important to ponder these things. The Ma'amari Chazal are well known to us, the dove said. But what exactly does the dove mean to say? One of the classic acharonim, more known for his halachic works, Rabbi Yaakov of Lissa. Rabbi Yaakov Lorberbaum of Lissa. So he's known as the author of Nesivos HaMishpat and Chavas Das, one of the major halachic authorities of the early 1800s. But he wrote on many, many things. And he has a sefer on Chumash also called Nachlas Yaakov. And as he does actually in a number of cases, so the first thing we need to know, says the Nachlas Yaakov, is that the dove is not a conscious player here. Meaning it's not something that the dove goes out of its way. It's not that the dove saw any number of leaves and made a decision to take the olive leaf so that Noah would get this message when it comes back. The only leaf available to the dove was an olive leaf. Whenever Chazal speak about animals or even inanimate objects talking, what that often means is there's a certain message that comes out. And Chazal phrase that as something that they say. But what it means is if you hear the message, it's like they're speaking to you. Lahavdil, but it's like Rabbi Akiva. and the water dripping on the rock until. But what's the message? The message is that over time, even a rock can be penetrated by drops of water if it's consistent enough. Neither the water nor the rock are consciously imparting that message. They're just each one following their nature. But there's a message that comes out, and if you receive it, so then it's been communicated to you, not by them, but from Hashem, from on high. And therefore, the reality of what is happening here is that HaKadosh Baruch Hu arranged that of all the types of leaves that would be accessible or available to the dove, there was only an olive leaf, and that's what it took. Why? So it is almost like an unwitting carrier of this message. When the Gemara says it's said to Noach, it means if you're sensitive and you realize what's happened here, you'll get the message, and it's as if the dove is telling you that message. That's how he understands what it means. Omra Yonah, to Noach. In fact, the lashon of the Medrash is Remez Ramzalo. It gave an allusion to Noach. But hopefully Noach understood. It's quite safe to assume, says the Nachlas Yaakov, that the dove did not understand the message it was carrying. It saw a leaf and brought it back. So these are very interesting discussions concerning these types of Ma'amore Chazal. And what's the message for Noach? As if to say, if Noach is sensitive and alert, he should hear that better to receive it directly from Hashem than to receive it from Noach. What is Shamayim trying to communicate to Noach? Perhaps is that the Noach, that his kindness should be pure, as if to say he shouldn't leave with that feeling, that elated, perhaps self-elevated feeling, that he is the one that kept the world going, but to appreciate that that was a stopgap measure, but the ideal is that everyone should receive directly from Hashem. And I think that the lesson for us outside of the Teva is also, as far as possible, to see our sustenance as coming from Hashem. If that's a message that the dove communicates to Noach, it's a message for everyone, both in the way that we request things and the way we go about trying to attain them and assess the results. So these are some comments with regards to this very interesting message of the Yonah. Bitter, like an olive from HaKadosh Baruch Hu, not sweet from people. It's a place to mention, I heard many years ago from my father, that's how it's got to be over 30 years ago, a story from Reb Chaim of Tzanz, the Rebbe, Reb Chaim of Tzanz. And his minhag was to bench loudly, so he got to the point, it's me'inyan le'inyan, but it's too good to pass up. He got to the point where so he says, "V'na'at tatzrichenu," or "V'na'at tatzrichaini," however it worked out. Lowly day badnas basav adam. Don't make us, need to receive gifts from flesh and blood. Lowly, we say in the benching. Lowly day badnas basav adam. On that occasion, sitting right next to the Rebbe was one of his major donors, one of his gevirim. So the Gevir, I don't know if he interrupted the Rebbe in the middle of benching, but he waited till the end and said, "Rebbe, lovely day masu savadam, I'm basav adam, you take my matonis, right? But if you want, I can stop. But make up your mind." But Reb Chaim Tzanz is a Hasidic Rebbe. So there are no obstacles. So the Rebbe said, when we say that we ask Hashem, look, everyone needs help from other people. I mean, that's the way of the world, and it's good, and it's a schutz for everyone, and if people give to the right things and receive in the right way, it's all good. The bakasha that we should never have recourse to lowly day matnas basav adam is because different people give in different ways. Some people give generously, and you really feel that they believe in what they're doing, and it's appreciated by them. For other people, when they finally give, it's like they're parting with their own flesh and blood. Lowly day matnas basav adam means don't put us in contact with people. We shouldn't need to be with people that when they give you something, it's like they're giving you an arm or a leg, with all the krechzing that goes with it, and you never hear the end of it. So he said to his gevir, "You're not one of those matnas basav adam people. You stay completely intact, and your donations come through." So that's the Rebbe on that occasion. Just to conclude our final. place to look at this evening is after the marble, and that is the rainbow. Of course, there's much discussion about the rainbow, and that's in Perek Tes. In the opening, let's just see the. It's really Psukim. It's Chamishi. So it's Perek Tes from Pasuk Ches, and the following Psukim. And so there's many Psukim actually, a number. It's not just two or three Psukim, as the Mefarshim discuss all these Psukim. The question that the Mefarshim discuss, Rishonim discuss, Ibn Ezra, Ramban, others, the primary Rishonim, is Hashem seems to say to Noah, I'm going to make a pact with you, there'll be no more marble, and I'm going to arrange a sign, and that sign is the rainbow. Now the question is, what are the implications of this? Does that mean that that the rainbow is a new invention? That it never existed before? It's now introduced into world experience as, post the marble? And Ramban is reluctant to say that, because there's a natural phenomenon. If it's about the way that the sun refracts off the moisture in the air after the rain, so why is that something that wouldn't exist beforehand? Some people say that it was a new introduction. Perhaps the rain worked differently before the marble, and atmospheric conditions were not conducive to a rainbow. But the Ramban is more inclined, and he even quotes Chachmei Yavan. The Ramban is no friend of Chachmei Yavan, but in terms of the natural sciences, and he explains the way that they explained it. It's the light refracting off the moisture in the air, and that's something that one can anticipate would have existed before the marble. But if it existed before the marble, then how is it a sign post the marble? Because it was there before, and now it's here again. So where's the sign? But the Ramban says there is a sign. It is a natural phenomenon. But it's now being enlisted as a sign for the marble. Life after the rain. In fact, if you look in Pasuk Yud Gimel, Perek Tes Pasuk Yud Gimel, and here we see, as we always see, how important it is to pay close attention to the words, not to gloss over anything. Pasuk Yud Gimel, Es Kashtina Sati Ba'anan, I've placed my rainbow in a cloud, Vaisol Os Bris Beini Ubein Ha'aretz, and it will be a sign of a covenant between me and the land and the earth. Says Ramban, you look at the Pasuk, you see there's two things being mentioned here. And grammatically they're mentioned differently. Eskashti nasati be'anan. There's two ways to refer to things in the past. Either, for example, haya, which is like the pure past, haya, or vayihi is also, and it was. So what's the difference between haya, it was, and vayihi, it was? The difference is, says Ramban, that the pure past means it already was. It's the past perfect. It's the pluperfect. It already was. Whereas ve means then this was, then this happened. So that's exactly what the Pasuk is saying. Eskashti, my rainbow, nasati ba'anan. I've already long ago put rainbows in clouds, right? They predated this conversation. But from this point onwards, v'haisola usbris, it will now be enlisted as the sign of the covenant. And why is a rainbow the sign of the covenant? I mean, what is it a sign? So Ramban says two fascinating ideas. I mean, the rainbow is a bow, and bows are used for war. But when is a bow a sign of peace? When you take the string out of the bow and it's just the arc, that's already a sign of peace. Because it's been disarmed. Alternatively, says Ramban, when people would meet in a conciliatory way, so the bow is always directed, the arc of the bow is always directed against the enemy. But when you meet in peace, he says they would reverse the bow towards them, with the other side towards their adversary, as if to say no harm intended. Says Ramban, the arc of the bow is facing away from the world. It's a conciliatory act. So says Ramban. But what we do see is that for Ramban, the rainbow itself is a natural phenomenon. And this brings us to an interesting parallel discussion, because as Rashi himself relates and refers to, there were certain individuals who were considered to be sufficiently righteous that a rainbow was never seen in their time. Chizkiyahu HaMelech, Reb Shim Ben Yochai, Reb Yeshua Ben Levi, that was kind of the hallmark of extremely, extraordinarily high level tzidkus, that their generation, a rainbow was never seen, implying that they never needed the reminder of the rainbow. That's what's behind it. But the question is, but how could a rainbow not be seen? If a rainbow naturally follows the rain, so then were the laws of nature suspended? This is the other side of the question. The first question is, was the creation of the rainbow a new supernatural phenomenon? But if it isn't, and it's natural, then is the suspension of a rainbow a supernatural phenomenon? As if to say, in conditions where normally a rainbow would appear, but for these generations it won't. So either way, there's a miracle somewhere. But there is an unbelievably simple and elegant explanation of these individuals, that a rainbow was never seen in their time as a sign of their tzidkus, and is found in one of the works of the Rama. We're familiar with the Rama, Rav Moshe Isserles, as for his glosses on the Shulchan Aruch and other halachic works. He has a sefer called Torah Sa'ola. It's a philosophical treatise on korbanos. It's absolutely out of this world, which is a polite way of saying I don't really understand it. But Tokidei, he comes to talk about many, many different things. And he has a short paragraph here. And he says, you know, there were certain people, a rainbow was never seen in their time. What happened? The laws of nature were suspended? Says the Rama, not at all. What does the Pasuk say in Parshas Bichukosai? V'nosati gishmechem be'itam. That when the Jewish people are acting as they should, the rain will be given in its time. When is its time? When is a good time to rain? Rashi tells us, Leil Shabbos, Friday night. Some say Leil Revi, also Wednesday night, but Leil Shabbos. Why? Because everyone's home, so no one needs to go out. Says the Rama, so you see that the hallmark of the Jewish people being on the level they should be is that it only ever rains at night. If it only ever rains at night, no one's ever going to see a rainbow after the rain. That's what the Gemara means when it says, talks about these people, Lo Nira Keshes Beinah. So, these are some of the many discussions of Parshas Noach. We'll leave it here for this evening and meet again next week in Mitzvah Shabbos.